Hi, it's Sveta and Ben, the world's number one impact investing expert. I have been educating thousands of people on the topic, how can you use finance as a force for good?
And I have been helping hundreds of entrepreneurs all around the world to set up, run, and establish their companies and businesses.
Do you even know what is impact investing? And how can you get engaged in that?
Did you know that in the coming years, we are going to lose 26 trillion of our GDP due to the climate change? But on the other hand, are you also aware of all the opportunities that the sector has to offer?
Are you aware of changing policies and businesses which already impact every little part of your life?
To have the answer to all these questions, come and join us at Swiss Impact with Banerjee's on every Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock Swiss time, starting from 15 January.
We will be interviewing thought leaders, world leaders, policymakers, investors, businesses, which are already engaged in this sector. So see you on Friday.
See you on Friday.
Good morning, afternoon, and evening to everyone. And from our viewers of Far East, good night.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Swiss Impact with Banerjee's. Hi, and greetings from Switzerland. It's great to be here again, 1 week after.
Exactly. So we decided to, as most of you know, and for the new audience, we decided to have this program in three visions. And today is the day for the investors. So let's start with, a short opinion of myself. I know that when I speak of impact investment, often people think, oh God, another charity or philanthropy or problems, they should be solved by the government or by some big multinationals or authorities with public money. That's far from home and it does not affect me. But then I also know that it's easy for us to focus on people who are fighting climate change or to be aware of impact investment. Few of you who knows me are aware that I often take the fight to the lion's den. For example, I speak about climate change at the Swiss banking, European bankers meetings, where people really look with big, wide eyes towards me. So I had mentioned a couple of times in the past, the two greatest threats to the investors. One is the issue with stranded assets, and especially visible in the sector of fossil fuel. And secondly, is the risk of the assets, the value decreation of the assets caused by climate change. In the world of Larry Fink, the head of BlackRock, and which is the world's largest asset management company, I think they have assets over $8 trillion US dollars. Climate transition presents a historic investment opportunity. Or when Mark Carney, the former governor of the British Bank of England, mentioned climate change is the investment opportunity of our generation.
Yeah, and if I may continue with this, the best part which I like is that impact funds like Generation of Vice President Al Gore or Global Strategic Fund here in Switzerland are all outperforming the mainstream, or how it's called, brown investment groups of traditional investment. So in conclusion, now it seems that all the early investors like the Brannick Myers from Netherlands or Rockefellers from US have been investing to actively change the world or at least avoid harming it further. The new ESG investors are mainly trying to avoid financial or reputational risk, retain and acquire new customers and assets and decrease losses. So it's not enough to say to address ESG investors, you can do much more and create deeper impact in our amazing world and amazing planet.
And like always, this time also I agree with you. Because it also emphasizes how important it has to become for people to understand what this new terms and this new sector is. And that's why we are very active also in education for the entrepreneurs, for the businesses and citizens, and raise their awareness of this topic.
So in just maybe to repeat for those in our audience who are not aware of such term like ESG, environmental, sustainable and governance practice, basically sustainable investment, impact investment. So what we are talking about, I'd like very briefly to define that, how we mean it when we talk about impact investing. So irresponsible investing is basically your exclusion of harmful industries such as tobacco, alcohol industry, pornography, gambling out of investment scope. Sustainability and ESG goes a certain step further, and they select the best companies in certain industry based on environmental, social, and governmental criteria, such as, for example, reducing CO2 emissions or reducing waste when you run a company. Or if you want to empower women, companies are also employing more women at top positions. So women empowerment or gender equality can be also the topic here, right? And last but not least, impact investment goes even further with the step that when we talk about impact investment, it's investment in companies which have an underlying mission and which create not only social and environmental impact, but also create a return, financial return, right? So we are not talking about philanthropies or charities here. It is an investment, but on the good side. So we invest in companies which are creating positive change in our world, and at the same time, they're financially self-sustainable. Okay, this was very in a nutshell. And now, and now the slide, which was just before, can appear again. And this is an invitation for everyone who'd like to learn more about profitable business with impact, how to create it. We will be teaching next week 2 days course, 2 hours each day, how to set up, structure, incorporate impact in your existing business, or if you are new, how to set up your business which create both impact and returns, high returns. And on the second day, I'd like to underline, because everyone is seeking for money, it doesn't matter if it's associations, projects, companies, we will focus on fundraising. So we'd like to help everyone who would like to find investors or different kind of investors. We'd like to focus on fundraising and help you how to do that, that you would get the money. And for those who register today, there will be a bonus session on the 18th where we will teach you step by step how to pitch successfully to an investor. Okay, and
You should introduce yourself a little bit. Why would anybody follow courses from you?
Well, yeah, I mean, thank you very much, Ben. That's a good point. I have experience of teaching more than 1,000 professional entrepreneurs with setting up their businesses or solving SDGs, so they themselves can call impact businesses, and then we open the doors to this amazing people like impact investors. Why amazing? By the way, it's a very good point. With normal investors, they just care about profit. So it's very important if you have a mission-driven business to find such investor that it is aligned with your mission. So you would have no mission drift. So the investor would support you with your mission and not just want to make more money. So keep an eye on our website and you will be informed about all these events and invited, of course. All right.
Thank you. And I'll just say a little bit about myself. For those who don't know me, I have been creating businesses, structuring them, developing them, funding them all over Europe since I shouldn't say it in reality, but it's more than 2.5 or 3 decades. So I've had the opportunity to set up companies in many West European countries, and mainly and really only in the impact sector. So here we are with our own family TV show. Although the show is all about impact investment, but we interview business, political, financial, and thought leaders from all over the world.
That's great. And today, I'm really excited to have our speaker. And as it's challenging, I think, for most of us who are not techies, Gurvinder Ahluwalia is the founder of CEO and Digital Twin Labs based in the US. He is a multi-talented person who comes from traditional IT sector. Previously, He was chief technology at IBM for blockchain, cloud, and Internet of Things, IoT, this word for North America, and an alumnus of the IBM Academy of Technology. Moreover, Kurvinder stewarded industry, businesses, public, and open source through recent waves of tech disruption in internet, mobile, cloud, and now blockchain. So all this, what you see around, I think Kurvinder had his hand and brain involved in that. So under his leadership.
Kurvinder, because otherwise half of the show will be gone with that's, reading your bio.
That's not the bio I sent. I think Svetlana colored it up.
Welcome, Kurvinder. It's Thank great you. To have you today with us.
What a pleasure. Thank you, Ben. Thank you, Svetlana.
So maybe you just shortly continues what I was saying, just a little what I missed maybe in your bio. What should our audience know behind the CV? Well, what inspired you to join IT sector as well?
Absolutely. By the way, my first goal on this discussion is to keep it simple.
Is that
a fair goal?
He's talking about me, basically.
Clarity, not about me, I think, you know, because women don't understand technology. They are struggling, most probably, you know. So let's keep it simple that everyone understands what they want.
And there is power in simplicity, but there is but to arrive at simplicity, there is complexity underneath of it, which really begins to allude to a lot of my background, and that has been in developing kind of complex systems and complex architectures at the forefront of technology waves. Let's say for the last 3-4 waves of technology, most significantly from the underpinnings of the internet. Around the turn of the century and prior, and then moving into kind of the cloud era, or between those two, actually, the mobile and cellular world that we are so anthropologically attached to, and then into kind of stewarding the industry with solutions around what we now see referred to as, you know, blockchain, IoT, and increasingly AI and machine learning. So I come from a heritage of looking at these solutions with an architecture, kind of a system solution architecture perspective, and don't let, you know, that throw anybody off. Just think of building architecture, civil architecture, and systems architecture actually borrows practices from there. But my point in giving part of that background is that where technology and the allocation to impact investments now is, at least for that portion which is inspired by digital technology, information technology, you can't purely get by. I can't purely get by looking at it from various dimensions of architecture. Technical and solutions kind of systems architecture, you have to look at it from various dimensions of disciplines, meaning you have to look at it from not just technology discipline, but legal and policy writing discipline, a little bit to the introduction that you provided of the show, quite a bit on, of course, economic and incentive disciplines and systems, and then also from the discipline of sociology. There's more to elaborate. I'll give it back to you. There's more to elaborate on any of these dimensions. But that has been the span of my career. Most recently, prior to my existing role as an entrepreneur and in my ventures, I was the chief technology officer for IBM covering North America, where I was part of the co-founding team of the blockchain business over there, and part of the co-founding team of the blockchain open source program called Hyperledger under the Linux Foundation. So let me give it back to you, and we can take it down whichever path you like.
Exactly. That's how I remember we met, because we were both speaking in Davos at WEF. And I think I made a couple of comments, and after the discussion, you came to me and said, "Well, I think somebody at least dares to speak his mind." I still wonder whether that was a compliment.
Well, that was a compliment, and also true to the introduction you gave, you take things to the lion's den, Ben. So absolutely.
Svetlana, you take over or me?
No, but share with us, what was your discussion about? Because I remember you were talking about values and technology in Davos. So what was your discussion with Gurvinder? Now we'd like to know.
Oh, that's a good question. I don't remember very well. I think I had mentioned something about, that's true. So the point was about when technology takes over and goes ahead of values, humanity can come into huge risks. For example, if you take the example of nuclear weapons, when we had more nuclear bombs, we could have destroyed or wiped each other out within minutes or within hours. But then slowly our values came back. So same is going on with the technology, with the sector of big data, blockchain, and everything. We have to keep our values up. Otherwise, this technology can become just as dangerous for us as anything else. Same was with internet. I mean, I hope people remember that when internet started, it started with the idea that it is the source of freedom, or freedom of democracy for democracy of information for everybody on earth. Today, that same internet can be peeking into your bedroom to see what you're doing. So it is, if our values don't catch up, I think that's something like that I had spoken. And at the end, Gurvinder came and said, at least somebody dares to speak his mind.
Gurvinder, do you have anything to add to that story, or we round up and continue there?
It is a very, very challenging, I wouldn't say very, very challenging, but also an opportunity area on how we are going to rewrite the next era of our, you know, information civilization or information age, whatever we want to call it these days. The New York Times recently ran a very powerful op-ed on basically the onslaught that we are facing as a result of invasion of privacy the author calls it an information on our information civilization, and it's a writer and author from who's a professor at Harvard Business School. Her name escapes me immediately. But it is a very, very real challenge, and it's no longer just about privacy. It's mm-hmm. about basically the influence that is being exerted mm-hmm. on political systems. And, you know, I won't get too much into it. The whole world has seen data points. But I will make kind of this point over here, which is interesting. And then, Svetlana, I'll give it back to you since I kind of had this. Are you able to see the slide?
Not yet.
To share.
Yes, yeah. Now it's coming. Yeah, absolutely.
And there is no sequence to my madness over here. And I just pulled up this slide because it was, I think, a little pertinent to the discussion around value and technology. And in some sense, the biases that we face as a society are getting built into the biases of systems. And in this particular case, AI, machine learning kind of systems. This is an example out of the US, which was through very good investigative reporting from the source mentioned over there, ProPublica, and basically talks about what kind of peaked in the US last year and got referred to as quite aptly as intrinsic racism. This is what is there in the software systems of criminal justice programs, of court management, of prison management, what, you know, district attorneys refer to in profiling prisoners. And it mm-hmm. so turns out that these algorithms are already biased against women, against Black women. Even if they are of a lower, history of criminal offenses, like you see on the right side, mm-hmm. she's profiled with a higher risk despite her lower offenses, and on the left side, there's a lower risk of a white male who has prior offenses dealing with armed robberies and grand thefts and so on and so forth. So the point being, I'll stop sharing the slide over here. So the point being that ethics have to be ethics that are there, ethics and biases that are there in our social systems and in our human systems, in the human network, I might say, basically are getting translated, and then it'll become more permanent into this new infrastructure.
But how can technology help to avoid such biases or overcome it? I mean, how do you see that?
I would put it differently. I would say, how did this bias come into the technology at all, unless it is corrupted data?
Right. I think, Ben, you answered the question very, very succinctly than I could answer it. Because these systems learn. Yeah, these systems learn from what we feed them, right? Eventually, this is garbage in, garbage out. So the fundamentals of computing don't change. And the programmers come with their own biases. The data that is fed is with its own biases. But unless there is a conscious and deliberate effort to bring the diversity into the programming and the design teams of these algorithms and the deployment of these systems, plus a diversity of attaining data and then checking it, you know, having circuit breakers, if you may, on looking for biases and not let the final state of automation and singularity kind of run wild on its own. You do need human intervention all along this path. So you do need human supervision all along the path on particularly such matters which are very, very sensitive. So back to you, Svetlana.
Yeah.
But still, I wonder, if it's even written, certain crimes which one person did, how can still the system make a mistake? Because it must be allocated the risk to certain robberies or whatever, murder. How can this still be biased,
Because well,
this is very strange.
Let me just extend the discussion, because it's not just to the existing status quo. So there is a challenge based on existing status quo of humanity and biases in humanity, which are getting translated into algorithm. I think there's a term being used called algorithms. So they're taking an organism form of itself, algorithms are. But I would extend the discussion to, cite some very, very powerful work that was done, I think, at MIT, which has now been a few years ago, and that's been written about extensively, called The Moral Machine. And so you now face very, very difficult situations, which otherwise you probably don't even think about enough. That if you're designing an autonomous car, then, and you have a choice between these may not be the exact examples in the work, and if the car has a choice of hitting an old man, let me make this more diverse, an old man versus a woman with a stroller. Right, you don't want to be in that situation. You don't even want to think about it. But if you are, and somebody could be, or the car could be, how does the car make that choice, or a choice between a motorcyclist and a pedestrian?
Mm-hmm.
Right, how does the car make the choice?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There aren't very good answers to these kind of questions. And then whose ethics do you go by? There will be different responses from different people. And there have been.
You will have different response.
Yeah.
But let's go back maybe to impact here.
Gurvinder, I hope you had remembered. I had warned you about Svetlana.
Well, in some sense, it has to do with impact on the ethical choices that we made.
Exactly.
Whenever we divert, she will bring us back.
There you go, Svetlana.
You have been involved in inequality, right? And by inequality, besides gender inequality, I think there is something else like digital divide, right? So could you explain this to the audience? What is digital divide and how you've been involved in that?
In all fairness, my involvement has been really rooted in technology. So I do speak with biases about that, but I was a technology purist, and I've increasingly over the last, decade and a half, seen the impact of technology and the connection to, societal behavior and challenges. The digital divide, actually is sometimes viewed very, very negatively, and that's not to perpetuate it, but to try to offer some clarity around it. There is digital divide, some of which is genuine and to be expected. There is digital divide between generations. You know, I can't use my thumbs on a cell phone as fast as, you know, my children and your children, I'm sure, can do it, right? So I'm not very productive, you know. So there is the digital divide. There is a digital divide. Ben, I think you and I were talking about it. I'm forgetting which situation we were referring to between you know, the elderly and elderly people like me and people like you. So in terms of
I like to live without iPhone, you know, really. Then people say, "Oh, you're not answering," but I like to live without it as well. So maybe I belong to the elderly one.
So there is that level of a divide, and that's not just digital. It would be in other, you know, capabilities and abilities as well, which have nothing to do with technology. But there is if I don't have a cell phone, or I don't have a smartphone, and I don't have an Uber app today, then I have to pay the premium to get an alternative mode of transportation from the airport, which is, you know, hailing a cab. I can't hail a Uber kind of a ride sharing without a piece of technology with me, but I can hail a cab without a piece of technology. But I'm paying for that premium because of my inability of having that. Similarly, the challenges of access to internet. Similarly, the challenges of not just the access, if the access is there, but the quality of the internet. We are privileged living in Europe and living in the US and many countries like this, but there are remote parts that I know a lot of your investments and efforts are closer to, where we wouldn't have, real time, the ability of an internet connection and stability like what we have in real time communications over here. So there are multiple angles to the digital divide, and that's why I wanted to kind of reflect on all of them. And then another one, which we might get into a little bit more over here, I'll just kind of seed the topic, and that is the digital divide related to access to capital and access to credits. There is a case from some of my work, which I can elaborate, later.
Yes, please. You can elaborate now, because we love to hear also practical examples.
Right. So
please share anytime, Govinda.
So one of my areas of expertise is IoT, as Ben and you kindly introduced. So the Internet of Things is, you've heard all the big numbers around it. I'm not going to, repeat that, but my engagement in IoT has been there for about over two decades. But most significantly, when I was leading up the, I was the chief architect at Texas Instruments, where we launched the first handheld device based on embedded Linux. Right, this is a piece of technology you don't need to worry about, but just know that Linux is what underlies pretty much every cell phone, Android or iPhone or anything else, which is in your hand. So it kind of, this work preceded, the mobile iPad, iPhone, Android era. But that was one of my significant contributions to the educational technology sector at that time, which, by the way, was like the next generation calculator, if you may. So my point over here is that IoT is a much, much wider field. And there was work I was involved in, which had to do with the use of, it didn't start with the use of IoT, but it started with market fractures in credit markets in Africa, because there wasn't good, for two reasons, because there weren't good credit profiles and credit data, and there wasn't good enforcement of contracts for recovery and proper contractual business, and a lot of that had to do with farming. So now we are having a social discussion, Now we are having an economic discussion. We are no longer having an IoT discussion. But the role of IoT in initiatives like that, in causes like that, is that if you're able to instrument farming, you know, farm environments and agriculture technologies, you know, tractor use, sprayers, other machinery, with an electronic hum, with IoT, with Internet of Things, you now of course have, you know, introduced technology, but who cares? Mm-hmm. But more importantly, you have insights and data that is coming out from the fields and use of assets, that you're able to arrive at the proper utilization of assets, which is important to credit lenders. You're able to arrive at the usage patterns and behaviors of the people involved over there, and therefore their credit profiles. And then if you take it a step further into blockchain technologies, I won't go there now, but I can talk about it later. On its role in decentralization and, you know, resisting kind of control, resisting censorship, you begin to then look at automated enforcement of contracts, right? So I promise to keep it simple. You basically,
it sounds not simple.
You basically, so let me summarize with simplicity. You basically now have farm environments would become intelligent because of technology, but more importantly, that is the kind of intelligence which gives information about the usage of assets and credit profiles, and enables lending and lowers the underwriting of lending and risk for participants in that economy. So that basically translates into better employment, better lending of credit, and growth in the GDP for those kind of sectors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I never thought about it, because I have been working with blockchain, not working, reading about it since a long time.
Yeah.
But this is one angle I didn't pay attention to, because we were, especially when you speak about Africa and blockchain, we mainly think about financing, communication, bringing people together, things like that. So the next question I want to do is that,
Ben, if I may, let me ground that point as an opportunity for the audience to examine further. So basically what we are looking for, and Ben, a little bit to what you triggered just now, basically what is important in investment impact is to look for opportunities and devise solutions that bring market making capabilities, mm-hmm. right? So you're now taking one side of the market, which is a population, which is, you know, people working in farms, and you're marrying that with an entity that provides credit data. You're marrying that with entities, banking institutions, or other forms of lending entities, and you're providing a market making kind of a capability. So it's no longer an IoT discussion, but it's a market making mm-hmm. kind of a capability, which is important to look at those kind of technology, but more importantly, commercial and social platforms. So sorry, Ben, I just wanted to...
No, you're completely correct, because I was recently talking with somebody on this topic itself. So mm-hmm. Then go to the next one. How you, as a technical investor, how do you look into the world of impact investment? Or what is impact investment from your perspective? Because I remember once you used the word impact is imperfect science.
yeah. So that's actually a good segue. The first part of your question is a good segue to what I just described. But let me answer the second part, which is impact is an imperfect science. When I say that, I really mean it, because of the number of disciplines that have to come into play in order to characterize something as impact, not just characterize, but also measure something as impact. So the work that is being done, in climate control, negative, not just neutral, but there are now being goalposts set to achieve not just neutral, but negative carbon impact. I would also point the audience to some very, very powerful work that is being done by Yale Open Lab around It happens to be around the use of blockchain, but more importantly, the use of blockchain for open climate, what's called open climate and open solar. And the word open is because all that entire knowledge repository, corpus of knowledge is in the open source. It's available to anybody to take a look at. So it's an imperfect, you know, impact investing is an imperfect science because of the dimensions that now come into play. And, you know, I wouldn't say it's, so there's infancy and immaturity, which is a natural part of the progression in how, in where we are in the ability for one discipline to look at the lens, look at through the lens of another discipline and vice versa. So let me take an example. Let me take my own example. I used to look at technology purely from the lens of technology. Let me improve that a little bit. I started to look at technology from the lens of an architect. An architect begins to look at multiple dimensions of a system. I'll just leave that thought over there. The where we are now with impact investing is, as I was saying in some of my opening comments, is that you have to look at impact investment not just from technology, which is one of the sources of inspiration or one of the kind of the dimensions, but also from the economics as well. But you can't look at it from traditional economics because you got to look at it from where, not where we are, not from status quo, but where the puck of innovation is going, right? Ice hockey kind of analogy.
Could you give a concrete criteria, Gurvinder? Sorry to interrupt. Like, so what are the concrete criteria? What's for you, or rules? What is for you impact investment? What is not in your technology area?
Yeah.
How do you look at that?
Yeah, so absolutely. So just to finish this quick thread, so the economics aspect, the incentive mechanisms, especially from decentralized technologies, and then also the aspects of sociology. I mean, when is the last time we really heard of sociology at the intersection of technology? We talk about economics at the intersection of technology quite a bit these days. So really the criteria come down to how do we bring market making? So platforms and capabilities that provide market making capabilities. I'm speaking obviously with a little bit of bias, you know, invested from the technology side. How do we look at the use of brand, for example? You know, brands can easily be abused. So think about a brand like, you know, Nike or McDonald's, and they could easily get abused and misbranded if they are channeled or they end up in a channel or in a media which has some criminal background associated with that. And the reason I say that is a lot of branding is now moving towards what's called influencer and streamers, right? Like we are streamers over here, right? So if you look at platforms like Twitch and Facebook Live and YouTube Live, so on and so forth, this, by the way, is the work that we are doing in my investment in a company called Streamsome, where I'm a co-founder as well. And there, it's important to ensure that the brand is reaching the right level of influence. You don't have control over influencers and streamers and gamers like brands traditionally have had control over, you know, traditional TV channels and radio channels in their advertising campaigns. So what used to be called brand management, marketing, brand management is now more consciously called brand activism. Mm-hmm. So that the brand is being associated and channels, and it appears in channels where which doesn't have any, you know, non-social, anti-social kind of behaviors. So really a little bit elaboration to the criteria over there. And that is the criteria on brand valuation, brand activation, and the capabilities to do that in a very, very large, portfolio of influencers, streamers, and kind of great gamers styled media. So Svetlana, that was touching a little bit to your question.
Yeah, and could you give a concrete example of a project or company which for you is impact investing in technology space?
Absolutely. So so this brings us quite naturally, I think I was expecting, or at least Ben and I were expecting this, to a blockchain discussion. but I'm not going to make this a blockchain 101 unless you trigger any questions later on. One of the areas that I worked extensively, well, there are two areas. I'll elaborate on one, and then if we need a wider discussion, I can touch on the second one as well. I think we all have a good idea, I don't remember the numbers offhand, on how much trade, global trade, happens through container shipment over the seas. And of course, those containers then go, on rail and on road and rail. This is work that I've done, incidentally, previously from my role at IBM.
But maybe let's announce the number. Not everyone in the audience know that. So. If I may say that 90% of global trade is carried by shipping containers, right? And 1956, the standardized containers were introduced. And do you want to give an example in Kenya, Gurvinder, or you had another example in mind?
Yeah. Thank you. So, if I remember the numbers correctly, it so happens that 50% of Kenya lives in, sadly enough, lives in poverty. One of the major success points in Kenya, and I think there's very good momentum, from the little bit that I'm reading on the Africa Continental Free Trade Agreement. I think the WEF only today or yesterday or just this week put out another refresher article and an update on it. Poised to be one of the largest trade, global trading zones, but a significant portion of exports from Kenya, after coffee and tea, I think the third one is agriculture and horticulture. Mm-hmm. And there is a very, very interesting use case and project that I worked on, and that had to do with the shipment of fresh cut flowers. Svetlana, I'm sure you would like.
I love flowers.
You would love those from.
Who doesn't like flowers? I don't like them being cutted, so I have a lot of plants which we plant, right?
Yes.
And they stay for long term with us.
So the lion's share of export of fresh cut flowers traditionally has come from South America, particularly from Colombia, meaning going towards Europe. So let's look at that trading pair, right? Going towards Europe. And Kenya was able to not just capture, but exceed their market share in global trade, against Colombian sources, South American sources. And what happens is, and these are fresh-cut flowers, so the connection to global container shipment, these are fresh-cut flowers that are shipped from Kenya to all of, the European Union. And Kenya has 25% of the market share of, fresh-cut flowers that are used in the European Union. But here's the real social impact point of that program. Most of the workers in the fresh cut flower, in the flower farms, agriculture, horticulture, are women, right? So now you are no longer having a global container shipment, and the global container shipment are, of course, not just important for those shipment, but the role of blockchain is to track the movement, not just the movement, the environmental climatic conditions of inside the container, because these are perishable, and that's why the case is very, very interesting.
Yeah, exactly. I was just asking myself in my mind how it's possible to deliver fresh cut flowers from Kenya to Europe, and then you need time to sell them. How do they survive, the poor flowers?
Yes. And by the way, just on the side, these are what are called reefers, which are refrigerated containers. Mm-hmm. And you might have heard the term cold chain. particularly with the recent WHO investigation in Wuhan in China, trying to trace where the COVID-19 virus actually came from. And there is now the possibility that the virus could have traveled in cold chain. So cold chain is a supply chain with controlled you know, temperature environments. So back to the discussion over here. So the technology related to those containers, which, as you pointed out, Svetlana, were invented in 1956, I think, and brought standardization and a pivotal point in global trade. Every container looks the same, and you can move it from a ship to another ship to a train to a truck or, you know, whatever, right? That's how. So there's huge efficiency. But after that, there hasn't been, you know, massive efficiency that has gone into that system. But now there is. So it's not so much about the use of blockchain to manage the movement and the environmental settings of those containers and the fresh cut flowers or other agriculture in it, including nutrition, which is another case that I worked with the Gates Foundation. But it translates, just to close up on the point, it translates to employment of women, raising women and other citizens in Kenya and other countries out of poverty levels. You know, you begin to see a direct impact from some of these kind of programs to society.
And is this impact measured as well? Because you were talking about impact measurement. So is it properly managed the same as an impact investing industry? Or how is it dealt with?
Yeah, there is challenge around measurement. So I'll borrow from my other work, which is from the Gates Foundation, which is for the supply of nutrition. I'm talking about basic commodity nutrition to large populations of humanity, particularly certain disadvantaged demographics. Particularly women young women of childbearing age that are getting food, but they're undernourished or malnourished. You could be eating food, but you could be undernourished and malnourished. That has an impact to not just childbearing, but it then has impact to health costs, healthcare of the system, and to the overall, you know, productivity of the population and to the GDP. You can begin to see the connections over there. So to your point around measurements, the challenge, and that's why the use of blockchain is being considered in some of these and AI and machine learning, incidentally, because they aren't very good measurements. Supply chains are very, very complicated, one of the most complicated systems. And as you pointed out, you know, the extent of global trade. And even if there are measurements, you end up with different data around the measurements. And then the measurements also have to be timely, because just as we talked about food and perishable, nutrition in grain, in oil also depletes over time, depending on how long a particular thing is stored in, you know, in a warehouse or in the supply chain. So those measurements are not just one-time measurements. They have to be taken at certain checkpoints to make sure that at the consumption point, those measurements are still valid. So the challenge is around measurement accuracy, measurement frequency, sharing of those measurements across the ecosystem. And those are the challenges which we are now trying to address in some of these programs like the ones I mentioned, by at least trying to pull those measurements that are being done into a common system, you know, underpinned by blockchain that can be shared within that ecosystem for compliance, for nutrition, for different purposes. So measurement is a challenge. I'm not going to, you know, come to the show and say that these systems and these, you know, systems that serve society have the right measurements. We are trying to solve the problem of shared kind of a single truth around those measurements for the ecosystem.
I mean,
Analyze
the impact measurement topic.
Yeah.
Because in impact investing, in general, it is challenging, you know, and there are no standards yet in impact investing. How to measure impact, there are various tools available, but there is still no standards and no obligation to measure impact. And what we think, it will change. There are some working groups like Impact Management Project, which are working on standardizing and making it a new obligation, like new, like, you know, this gap, global accounting system. So you need to make your accounts, and the same will be for impact measurement. So it will be obligation to measure the impact you're creating. And one last point about supply chain. How about like delivering flowers from Kenya to Europe? It's really a lot of CO2 emissions if you use shipping, right? Why can't we grow local flowers in Switzerland, in Germany, France, all over Europe? I mean, they are growing flowers there. Why do we import flowers from Kenya?
It's because it brings trade brings humanity together. So if every country does everything that it needs itself, then that's an isolationist kind of an approach. Sorry to put it back that way, right? Yeah, I'm sure Europe can grow its own flowers, even if it costs more. But yeah, you'll end up with a smaller carbon footprint because you won't have this, you know, nonsense about, you know, global shipments. So why does it have to be fresh flowers? You know, every country in Europe can grow its own wheat and its own rice and produce its own, you know, milk and dairy. And, you know, where do we end the story?
Yeah, let's go to local. Why not? Everyone is talking about that. What's wrong with that?
Right.
Own tomatoes, which are smelling tomatoes.
There we go.
The problem is you get tomatoes from somewhere, but they don't even smell like tomatoes.
I think it's... Know? Yeah, that's true. It's I think there are. I mean, I think I don't mean to dismiss the argument you are offering and trying. I'm hoping it's rhetoric and you don't really mean it.
Remember, Goodman,
I used to have hair like you. Now look what happened.
Well, in my case, you can't tell, right?
Exactly. We don't know.
We solved that problem many centuries ago.
But I was just thinking now there's this new laws kicking in. In Europe also, they're doing that for investment. Yeah. That they want to track. So if you are doing a business or if you're investing in a business, they want to track the whole supply chain end to end. And this is not only for normal products, it's also for mining products, products which are coming from the mine. They want to see that the diamonds or whatever coming is completely end to end, that is not a blood diamond or something. Or with cobalt, the same thing. Couple of other mining is coming the same. So maybe it's something to think about if you have still time in your hand. Maybe you can start working on a project, investing in a project which solves this issue.
Yeah, no, it's a really good point. Unless you measure it, you can't manage it. Even though that's a very fatigued kind of a phrase, but it's very, very, excuse me, it's very, very applicable. And as we get into the lion's den, I love that phrase, Ben. as we get into the lion's den in solving problems of global scale, we will not be able to do it without the right measurements and without the right truth and data. I have a love-hate relationship with data, which has been talked about extensively and its importance, but 80% of the data of the world is dark.
What do you mean by dark?
Dark means it's untapped. I mean, it's there, but it's really not being used. That's what's referred to as, you know, dark data. It's just locked up in X-rays. Look at healthcare, which incidentally is one of the largest volumes of data that is being produced. Imaging and scans, because that's also very dense data. Industrial or B2B, business to business data, is being produced 6x faster than social data. We think social networks are crazy. So the point about the love-hate relationship with data is that a lot of it is dark. It is just so massive, and we are drowned with it. But the problem, the problem with it is that the jury is still out on the proper monetization of data. or compliance, Svetlana, to your point. The jury is totally out on the accuracy, meaning the truth of that data. Everybody has their own
version. What do you mean by jury is out? You mean the decision is still to be made?
Yeah, well, I mean, if you look at corporate investments that have gone into big data, so you think about cell phone companies, right, cell phone operators, and they've used big data about their consumers, about their customers, to analyze and to predict customer churn activity. And whether that has really, whether that data and those investments have yielded results in reducing attrition of customers, it's not entirely clear that it has, right? So the results on monetization, on using data for monetization, are ambiguous. That outcome is ambiguous. So going back to Ben, your point and something that you cited, and it really grounds the point that Svetlana makes around measurement. And you mentioned the diamond industry. There are two programs in this world which have looked at the global trade of diamonds running on blockchain kind of supply chains.
Right? Oh, here we need to stop, Gurvinder. Sure. When we say blockchain, I'd like you to challenge you and define blockchain in two sentences so everyone understands that.
Including me.
Because I just wanted to ask you about blockchain again, not to disappoint our techies who joined today. But the plan is that blockchain must be defined as clear as possible for everyone. And then we go deeper into this amazing topic.
Okay, good. Thank you for keeping me honest, because I wanted you to do that. And just remind me after we get done with this to come back to the diamond point and close out on
absolutely. We will not forget that. It's very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, particularly to women, right? So it's a fresh cut flowers and diamonds, right? I mean, we made the Svetlana show here, so so blockchain is of course it's a technology, right? But it's a platform for ensuring truth in data. That's one, right?
Ensuring truth in data. I love that. Okay.
Yeah. Right. Blockchain is also a system of governance, right? And governance becomes important when you have a multipolar world, when you have multiple parties. If you have one party, governance is not important. If you have two parties, governance is really not that important. You can hash it out. If you have three, maybe still, right? You have a consortia or something, right? But if you have more and you're dealing with the kind of social systems that we are touching upon, then blockchain offers a governance system on how privileges, how voting, how do we decide? So I made the point that it's blockchain is a platform for truth of data. And you should ask the question now on how do you arrive at that truth? Right?
How do you arrive at that truth?
Right? Which is the second point that I'm making, and you arrive at that truth through a shared governance model, right? Through a shared governance model. So that's the second point I want to leave with. There are three points here in defining, right? So it's a model for truth. You arrive at the truth through a shared governance model, right? With equitable privileges. And then the last thing is you incent participation, because you can't have shared governance without parties coming to the table to share, right? So there are incentive mechanisms in blockchain which incent people to participate, right? So you don't have to, you're not muscling, you're not strong arming, you know, a big entity, and not strong arming a smaller entity, and so, you know, those kind of those kind of gaps, if you may, corporate or social, into the system. So, so Svetlana, my takeaway to your question, and thank you so much for triggering it. And my takeaway to the audience.
No, thanks a lot. It was really useful. I think for everyone who did know, it was really to the point. So thanks a lot. And now let's go to global trade of diamonds and in blockchain.
Okay, so if you exactly. So now if you take those three things, right? The truth in the data, shared governance, and incentive mechanisms. What's the problem, right? If that's the answer, what's the problem? So what's the problem in the diamond industry? So the problem in the diamond industry, and by the way, there are two programs of any significance in the world of experimenting and putting the global trade of diamonds on blockchain technologies. And I, in all humility, will say that I've been privileged enough to work on both those programs, one from my prior role at IBM for a startup entity, and then from my role at Digital Twin Labs for De Beers in London. So the problem in the industry is there's $40 billion of insurance fraud related to diamonds, and that's a US
$30 billion, you said?
Just I think 40 billion or so. So I'll check the numbers. I might have it noted somewhere. So 30-40 billion, basically, for purposes of this conversation, there's billions of dollars, tens of billions of dollars of fraud, and that's
a lot of money.
A lot of money, exactly. And that's
I think it's 40 billion. So 40 billion of insurance fraud in luxury goods,
40 billion. Yeah. So I'm staying honest with you, Svetlana, measurement is important, right? So, and that's just a US number. There are significant, and if we go beyond the diamond industry, there's significant numbers around the luxury goods environment, luxury goods industry, on, you know, how much is, you know, fake, counterfeited goods in that industry. Now, it's not so much that diamond is a luxury item, and you know, a large part of the audience might say, I don't care about diamonds. It doesn't pertain to me.
It doesn't. By the way, I have no diamonds, you know.
That's Ben's problem. So,
Gurvin, you're making my life very difficult. Can we move over to flowers?
So if we come back to, I don't care that it's a luxury item. As a technologist, I don't care. But what I do care, it's something that is drawn from the earth, just like, you know, oil was and is, and just like new, you know, rare minerals and materials are being investigated for, you know, next generation alternative, you know, battery kind of energies and battery technologies. So it's something that is being drawn from the earth, you know, back to stakeholder capitalism, you know, which is on the WEF World Economic Forum agenda, and the role of the earth as a stakeholder around the table. So it's not interesting to me that diamonds are expensive as a technologist, but it is interesting as a change maker that they come from the earth. But what's also more interesting is that we want to weed out from the retail gene pool, blood diamonds, right? So now if I can track, Ben, you made the point end to end, right? So governments, societies, corporations, organizations are looking for end to end tracking. So if we can track the entire journey of a diamond from what's called mine to market, and exactly which mine in Africa it came out of, and then from there it was handled by this identity, by this company, and then it was shipped by this courier, by this shipping logistics company, by these forwarders to Surat in India, which is the diamond polishing cutting capital of the world, incidentally, and who handled it over there, and then closer to your neck of the woods in Antwerp, Belgium, which is the diamond exchange capital of the world, and then onwards to retail markets and jewelry makers, right? So you can think of the number of touch points, and anything could have happened to that diamond in order to preserve its asset and its provenance. So the term that is commonly used in the blockchain literature and vocabulary space is the word provenance, which is a fancy way of saying what you said simply, Ben, that is the end-to-end tracking. But it's more than just tracking, right? It's more than just tracking. You know, who touched that diamond at any point in time? So those are, so it's about, and then not just the ethical use of workforces along that entire chain, also weeding out any money laundering, which is propelled by the diamond industry in some parts of the world. Also weeding out, terroristic activity, which is also propelled by the diamond industry in certain geographies. And the United Nations has something called the Kimberley Process, which lays out a set of rules to certify diamonds, and there are 80 countries that are signatories to it. But then it comes back again, Svetlana, where are the real-time, low-cost instruments to measure this complicated journey and diamond
industry? Exactly. How far are we in this journey? Because I hear this, first time I've heard about it, maybe 5 years ago. And where do we stand now? Because the technology exists not the first year, and the idea is great end-to-end, but where do we stand with that? Why it's not yet a new normal in the supply chain industries?
Yeah, well, in the diamond industry, it's adopted pretty well, and there have been very powerful people and massive capital, including investment VC capital that has gone into some of these startups that I'm referring to. Of course, we all know De Beers is a very, very powerful entity, and its parent company is 20% owned, or 10 or 20%, I'm not entirely sure, by, I believe, the Republic of Botswana, the government. So they're very, very powerful entities behind this industry. And again, this is just one example. So there is good adoption. And actually, it was quite surprising that the diamond industry adopted, a very, very advanced technology like blockchain information technology. When is the last time you ever heard of, digital innovation in the diamond industry? And at a point where I was active, and these are numbers I can share from my work at IBM, because they are public numbers. And in that work, 1.2 million diamonds were onboarded onto the blockchain. And then also,
How many are there in the world?
Yeah, I don't know, but it is a very, very small. It was a very, very small number. Mm-hmm. This was done in the early stages of the project. Mm-hmm. Basically, the challenge is more around onboarding the ecosystem of players of these various countries I just took you through, like Africa and Belgium and India and wherever, getting them onboarded onto the ecosystem to kind of share the data. So the program, I'm sure, is much well along in its way than when I was active in it. I don't have the latest numbers on what volumes of diamonds are traveling on these two major blockchains of the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I read once long time back with the blockchain, we also read about the cotton, because cotton also is a problem issue, because a lot of cotton comes from where major companies don't want it to be coming from, like there's a shearing cotton and things like that. And they were considering a lot of major fashion industry or textile companies were thinking about installing blockchain to control end-to-end to follow up with the cotton supply.
Yes.
So it's quite a similar case.
It is a similar case. So, and I think this is really the fruitful discussion, because you have a very, very popular and diverse audience for your show. I'm just a fly-by shooter over here. You're the one that kind of hold the fort down. And with the diversity of your audience, I think kind of the one of the crux of the takeaway is a little bit to Svetlana's point around criteria is, we talked about kind of market making, we talked about measurements, and those criteria are really, really important. It almost doesn't matter whether it's a diamond or cotton and or nutrition elements like calcium or zinc or whatever, essential to humanity, all populations of humanity. It almost doesn't matter. So from the framework of investing from a framework of a technology, which is where I come from, it almost doesn't matter. You're basically responsible for a certain cargo that has to go from A to B. And now you're going for criteria of custody around those assets. You're going for criteria in investing, which is looking for equitable partnership, participation, I should say, equitable participation, which raises, you know, where the tide raises all the boats. You're looking for fair mechanisms of incentivization. I'm trying not to use the word compliant, because then that introduces a government angle, which is important. Yeah. You're looking for compliance whether it is, you know, anti-money laundering, whether it is terroristic activity, or even health and safety, right? Like what we are dealing with in the middle of the pandemic.
So basically, if we look at SDG, Sustainable Development Goals, we can say that blockchain is supporting number 3, good health and well-being, number 8, decent work and economic growth, number 9, industry, innovation and infrastructure, and also 16, peace, justice and strong institutions. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I would agree. Are you looking at the SDG framework?
Yes,
yeah. Yeah. I mean, it depends on how you join the dots, right? So the work that's being done, I talked about the work that I'm doing with the Gates Foundation. You could draw a line. You could actually draw quite a direct line between technology like blockchain and world hunger, right? I think this one of the goals is zero world hunger by
01. Yes.
2030. Yeah. I don't know if there probably isn't a granularity to that, but underneath of that might be, you know, nutrition, with proper nutrition, not just hunger, what with the proper nutrition. And and that tracking is, you know, those investigations are being attempted on the blockchain for supply. So, as you might guess, my origins are from India. And that was one of the countries I studied in the context of these programs a little bit closer than other countries. It applies to all countries, by the way, including advanced countries like US and countries of Europe. The Indian government from the central level, from the prime minister, directly from the prime minister level, has mandated 5 food items as commodity, which are commodity items that have to be part of, you know, kind of this program for what's called fortified nutrition, right? Fortified nutrition. So you fortify the grains. You, like, you know, what is the staple food that is that is eaten by a population? In India, it is, you know, rice, it's flour, atta and chapati, right? And those kind of things. And I think milk might be in it, and oil is consumed quite widely. You go to Africa, you go to a country in Africa, it'll probably be the same, one or two, you know, few others. You go to some countries in Asia, the Far East, it'll largely be the same, but it'll be probably a few others. Rice is, as we all know, one of the most common staples across the world. Yeah. So if you embed it with fortification of nutrition and minerals important for the human body, then those measurements are tracked, to my point around those 3 definition aspects of blockchain. They're tracked on the blockchain. And then that begin to give a direct line of sight into the Zero Hunger SDG initiative.
I'd like to ask the following question, because looking from different perspective, from investor perspective and project perspective, if you're an investor and you want to invest in technology with impact, so blockchain or some other, where do I find projects? Where do I source such deals? What is the best platform or conference, whatever you are? Where do you find your investment?
Well, Chamomile is one platform to look for, which is bringing some of those participants together. Outside kind of platforms, community kind of platforms like that. a lot of this world is kind of just happening under the radar. I wouldn't say under the radar because it's happening publicly, but it's so esoteric.
In dark. No, it's happening in dark.
Right? Yeah. It's kind of, exactly. So for those people, so
we'd like to make light on that, you know, that everyone could invest in such things.
Yes, yes. So if you go look at, you know, so let me just switch a little bit to this very, very exciting and vibrant, but at the same time, chaotic world of DeFi or decentralized finance. You know, of course, it's all tied to the world of cryptocurrencies. And it might sound like it's a great time to talk about it, given where Bitcoin and all these cryptocurrencies are going and Tesla making investments and institutional investments. But people that have been longer in this and kind of sustained and endured with stamina to advance this paradigm, you know, people like me and, you know, more people far more capable than me in this side of the industry, we are close enough to see where it is going. So as they say, the future is already here. It's, you know, unevenly distributed. So if you go into this uneven distribution, and there's information that is available on sites like Coinbase. I don't know if that's popular in US, but it's very popular in Europe and other parts of the world. But it's a US-based company, and obviously very, very popular.
I've heard about that one, yes.
Yeah, it was one of the most, a few years ago, it was one of the most downloaded apps on Apple's App Store, probably a couple of years ago when it really hit it big. So access to these apps is two responses to your question, Svetlana. Mm-hmm. One is from a consumer standpoint, right? To just like consumers invest in application in the stock market and, you know, other investment areas, the retail investor, right? Then these kind of apps, you go to, you know, Coinbase, there are a few other like Bitfinex, and these are what are called decentralized exchanges. Binance is another one.
And then you can trust them. They will not disappear next day or something.
I'm not the authority.
There were some cases here in Switzerland, you know.
I'm not the authority, but yes, those are the ones that have endured and they seem to be reputed. And then if you go to Korea, there's a whole vibrance of decentralized exchanges or exchanges for, I shouldn't call them decentralized exchanges. That's a different kind of topic, but exchanges for cryptocurrencies and decentralized finance, DeFi kind of tokens. So if you go to, you know, in different geographies, certain apps are more popular than they are in other countries, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a little bit of that, right? But it doesn't matter once you get into those apps and that's your entry point. Now, the next thing you do is you begin to investigate what kind of projects are happening. I'm calling it projects, but they'll be listed as coins. They'll be listed as crypto coins, right? So a crypto coin, I don't mean to introduce new vocabulary over here, but since I risked doing that, I should say what it is. A crypto coin is a digital asset representation of an underlying market. Let me just sort of leave it at that, right? So there could be, you know, a crypto coin or a token related to the diamond industry. By the way, to complete the connection, when I gave you three definitions to blockchain, the third one had to do with incentives, right? Mm-hmm. So you can invite them. So coins have to do with incentives. Coins are the mechanisms for incenting the participants, right? So let me just leave that aside and come back to the main point over here. So you basically go into those marketplaces and those apps and you look for these projects. You look for these crypto coins and tokens and you study those. And if they look interesting, you can go in as a retail investor or you can contact their, you know, the founders at the back and go in, you know, more as a professional or institutional investor. There are hundreds and hundreds of, I'm just talking about the DeFi category of opportunity. And there is an impact angle to this as well. And most of them, incidentally, right now, are being built on top of Ethereum, which is the second most highly coined coin after Bitcoin. You're right.
Can I get a bit personal here? So sure. Given that you come from Punjab, which is like the bread valley of India, so through ancestors, farming, agriculture has been the strength of Punjab. And how would you look at, because I know that Indian agriculture system still has a very long way to go. It's extremely good, but it is extremely fragmented, inefficient, the wastage is high. So what about now? Slowly I'm hearing more and more people are coming up with apps and technologies to increase the production, to increase the effectivity of the agriculture system. How would you look at these applications or these apps which are coming out in India? Because recently there are some very, very famous ones coming out which will sell the farmers, that farmers can sell their product directly to the end consumer without going through all the things. So how do you look at the agriculture sector?
Yeah, very, very important point, and particularly keen to my heart, not just coming from Punjab. I, you know, grew up mostly in Delhi, but then all over the country. My father was in the Air Force, so we moved around a lot, but also because of the farmer problem that is going on, which is now at a global kind of a, you know, knowledge and awareness level. Just to cue in a thought over there, you know, the last time major revolutions and improvements in farming and agriculture happened were around the 60s and the 70s, when cattle from New Zealand were brought and studied and brought, and cattle technology was brought over to solve the milk problem in India. And that did result in kind of a whole milk, you know, white revolution in India. And while during my growing up, that's when we saw it, and like milk was available on tap, basically. And similarly, the Green Revolution came from Punjab, motivated by international technologies and practices around farming. And that solved, I mean, we're talking about, you know, a billion people over there, more than a billion. And that solved, I wouldn't say solved, but took to a very, very good new plateau on, you know, hunger and starvation and nutrition in India. So from the point of view of, you know, green and yield, farm yield, India has done very, very well. And a lot of its grain is also exported. Mm-hmm. So there's surplus. But the challenge over there is around automation. The challenge over there, this is more to your point directly, Ben, the challenge over there is around bringing more market-making capabilities. The challenge over there, let me use this word carefully, because we do enter the lion's den when we say this, and that is removing the intermediaries. So part of blockchain, but forget about blockchain, part of the whole paradigm and movement of decentralization is removing the intermediaries that are not adding value. And there are now technologies to compress those supply chains and market making relationships by the use of technology like decentralized technologies. Those capabilities are there. That is the state of the possible, not the state of the art, right? Not cutting edge, bleeding edge. So there is a lack, and you're right, to phrase it positively, there is a huge opportunity to bring in market making capabilities. The problem that I described in about farming and you know, credit lending in Africa markets applies to India farming industry as well, where the suicide rate of farmers has been very high because they're not able to pay back the lending that they have borrowed from banks, and then they, you know, these banks come kind of chasing them. So, you know, those lending mechanisms, those lending profiles and asset utilization is what exactly the case that I described about Africa would apply towards automation and market making and creditworthiness in farmers, in farms in India. Svetlana, you got something? Yes.
Yes, we have just 5 minutes and we have some questions from the audience.
Yeah, right? I was going for that.
So I wanted to take that. I was the first. So, question.
That I told you, she's smarter than me.
than all of us.
First question about definition, because it's I find it interesting. How crypto is different from Ashrafis, an ancient currency?
If I remember, Ashrafis are basically also coins. So Ashrafis are not very different from currencies of today. The only difference is the political system, and therefore the fiscal system is different, where you have central banks pretty much in every country that are managing the currencies, that are minting the currencies and managing the monetary policy, not the fiscal, but the monetary policy, stand corrected. So I think Ashrafi's, if I'm remembering, you know, back from my background also, the term refers more to when there were kingdoms, and, you know, kings would mint their, and those empires and kingdoms would mint their own currency. So in that sense, today's currencies are not very different from the model of Ashrafi's. But I think what you might be asking, or just to extend the discussion, the main difference in crypto coins and Ashrafi's or today's currencies is the elimination of intermediary parties and controlling, you know, central bodies. Now that's a huge tug of war that is going on between central banks and the entire Bitcoin and cryptocurrency movement. And I shouldn't say elimination. I should phrase it not carefully, but in my view, accurately. It's not going to be the elimination of central bodies, but it's the resistance to censorship, yep, right, of cryptocurrencies. Mm-hmm. And if this is my money, this is my wealth, I want to control it. Yep. Right. I want to be. Now, there are policy and international and embargo kind of implications to that, and the power of countries. Valid discussion, but I think the point over here is what is the innovation in the role of in the future role of modern government, modern political systems, central banks, that mm-hmm. they will play in this portfolio of currencies, mm-hmm. right? So we are not headed to, you know, either the dollar or the euro or Bitcoin. That's not the discussion or the argument that I'm advancing, but how does this coexist in a portfolio of currencies that the future world will work with? So that's my response to the question over there.
Okay, thank you. Can I take one last question, because I really find it interesting?
I wouldn't dare to comment.
How the world will act once 5G is available around? And please also define what is 5G.
How the world will act once 5G is available around. So, well, I appreciate the question. I was privileged enough to give a keynote at the, you know, a couple of months ago at the India Mobile Congress, which was the flagship 5G conference for, you know, South Asia. And incidentally, I did systems engineering for 3G handsets, the work I was describing previously. And now, of course, we are at 5G. So 5G is most significant at its very, very low latency capabilities, meaning just, you know, low latencies and the delays that we have to deal with cellular communications today. But 5G is not so much for kind of voice and video, which we already are pretty happy with on cellular technologies. Yeah, we can, you know, use a little bit of improvement. But 5G is going after actually the IoT space. So that mm-hmm. is, we can't have the IoT space. So all the discussion we had around farm instrumentation and farm equipment and, you know, measurements in the supply chain and all that kind of stuff, it has to tie, the digital world has to tie with the physical world. That's a little bit, you know, no plug intended over here. That's a little bit too, you know, the digital twin notion, you know. Mm-hmm. So there is a huge communication, like a latency kind of network gap. And 5G is advanced for very, very low latency, which makes the case of bringing IoT to these kind of use cases that we discussed, whether farm, whether diamond, whether measurement and nutrition, so on and so forth, bringing it within easier reach and production or autonomous driving and safety, right, those kind of things. But those are the technologies, that's the technology dimension. And I come back to my thesis to all of you, is taking that technology dimension, but then tying it into how does it solve the employment? How does it solve the poverty problem? The examples on Kenya that I described to you, right? So if I instrument with IoT and 5G smarter containers, global shipping containers, does that provide me better assurance on the climate in that, mm-hmm. that container to ensure farming jobs and better improve poverty levels in, you know, Kenya or Uganda or wherever? So you got to look at it from the social impact. of 5G as well. And I think there's a very, very bright future that we are poised over there for new technologies. So thank you for the question, Svetlana, back to you.
You're welcome. Thank you so much. I've learned so much today. Really happy.
You learned so much. Yeah. So, ladies and gentlemen, this was Gurvinder Singh Ahluwalia from United States. And we come back again next week. Next week, our guest would be His Serene Highness Prince Michael of Liechtenstein, who is not only the founder and chairman of the Geopolitical Intelligence Services, but he's also the executive chairman of Industry and Finance Control. And he's board member of a lot of financial institutions. So he's an investor and advisor to technical and innovative and financial industries. So see you all next week. Bye-bye.
See you on Friday. Act and impact. Thank you, Gurvinder.
Thank you, Ben, Svetlana. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Hi, it's Sveta and Ben, the world's number one impact investing expert. I have been educating thousands of people on the topic, how can you use finance and force for good?
And I have been helping hundreds of entrepreneurs all around the world to set up, run, and establish their companies and businesses.
Do you even know what is impact investing? And how can you get engaged in that?
Did you know that in the coming years, we are going to lose 26 trillion of our GDP due to the climate change? But on the other hand, are you also aware of all the opportunities that the sector has to offer?
Are you aware of changing policies and businesses which already impact every little part of your life?
To have the answer to all these questions, come and join us at Swiss Impact with Banerjee's on every Friday afternoon, 3 o'clock Swiss time, starting from 15 January.
We will be interviewing thought leaders, world leaders, policymakers, investors, businesses, which are already engaged in this sector. So see you on Friday.
See you on Friday.